perhaps we can call it an unprecedented level of global groupthink. Normally, groupthink isn't actually a positive term.
No, it's not.
It sort of describes lemmings all going off a cliff
together. That's exactly right.
But there is a certain amount of groupthink to be used to characterize what happened as 47 world leaders in Washington wrapped up a communique after a two-day nuclear summit that calls on all nations present, some of them historic enemies like India and Pakistan, to cooperate in keeping nuclear material out of the hands of terrorists. This morning we want to explore, first of all, how an initiative like this can actually counteract the global black market for nuclear materials and get a sense of what that market actually is. Returning, of course, is David Sanger, New York Times chief Washington correspondent, author of the book The Inheritance, The World Obama Confronts and the Challenges to American Power. He joins us from Washington. David, good morning once again.
Good morning.
And Sharon Squassone directs the Proliferation Prevention Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. She also joins us from Washington. Good morning, Sharon.
Good morning.
David, first question, does an initiative like this actually hold the promise concretely to counteract black market nuclear terrorism? And many have said that the black market has had a jump on the international community for quite a while now.
Well, the black market has had a jump, and that's why I guess I'd use a slightly different phrase. I don't think it was global groupthink. I think this was global guilt trip, because there have been any number of agreements. In 2004, the United Nations General Assembly passed a resolution that required all countries to lock down their nuclear materials. There have been conventions, agreements, you name it. There's a long list of sort of legal documents around this. And yet, what was the Obama administration happiest about yesterday? An agreement with the Russians to both close down a plutonium reactor that they used to use for weapons, but also to finally clean up 34 tons of material that actually there had been an agreement signed by Al Gore with the Russians to go clean up in 2000.
Interesting.
And you sort of ask the question, so what happened in the ensuing 10 years? And the answer was almost nothing. And that's true in a lot of these different places where none of these sites that they've agreed to clean up are particularly newly discovered. It's just a question of motivating. And I think that part of the president's calculation was that if you got leaders to show up rather than a group of lower-level officials, it would sort of force the issue. And next, there's going to be a summit in 2 years in South Korea. And the president made very clear that what he was doing was planning to come out and review with those same leaders how they've done on their work plans in 2 years.
So it's not just a conference. It's a process that the president has envisioned here. And we'll just have to see how it works out. Sharon Squassone, let's talk for a minute about what kinds of messages have to get down to the sort of market level to prevent the sorts of transactions that are really the scary nightmare scenario here. How is that going to work, and how does these leaders being so high profile about this actually hold the promise of intervening in this black marketplace?
I think the main issue here is securing the material at the sources. There's a difference here between the Obama administration and the Bush administration. The Bush administration, while it thought that physical protection, et cetera, were, you know, was a good thing to do, it focused a lot on the more visible interdiction efforts. So we had the Proliferation Security Initiative. We had all kinds of efforts to go out and get that material. Here, and I think David Sanger is absolutely right, what it really takes is leadership from the top. You know, when a president or a prime minister speaks and says, I want this done, it gets done. Let me give you one example. In Ukraine, which is they've decided to give up their highly enriched uranium.
And they've already given up their warheads, right?
Absolutely.
Right.
They had 75 kilograms, and they still do, of fresh, highly enriched uranium fuel. This has been sitting around in a facility at Kharkiv for many, many years. And as a matter of fact, we had some reports that Iraq was seeking that HEU in 2002. The U.S. offered to buy it. The Ukrainians said, no thanks. So the fact that, you know, this is a forcing mechanism, the Ukrainian leader comes here to Washington, he says he's going to give up this material, and let's hope it happens soon.
All right, Sharon Scorsone, I want you to listen to the voice of a colleague of yours talking about the way the black market actually works for nuclear materials. This is Rolf Malott Larsen.
There's a lot of things out there. There's scams. There are components. There are people trying to make a buck off everything, as you'd imagine. For purposes of the nuclear terrorism threat, it's the weapons usable material that's appeared for sale by groups that are willing to sell it to virtually any buyer if they can come up with the money. But we're talking about the real deal, genuine article of weapons usable materials that really comprises the threat space we're worried about.
Rolf Malott Larsen is a senior fellow at the Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs up at Harvard. How do you think this black market has changed since AQ Khan, the Pakistan bomb maker, really sort of established a black market many years ago?
I think there are two kinds of black markets. One we saw emerging as the Soviet Union fell apart. And that was one of the reasons why Senators Nunn and Lugar at the time decided to put a lot of money, at least $1 billion every year, into going to these facilities all over Russia and the former Soviet Union and beefing up security. AQ Khan is a very different animal, and he set up his own facilities worldwide for manufacturing materials and components. It's not just the materials that he was selling, but he was selling technology. He was selling centrifuges to countries like North Korea and Iraq.
Sure.
And Iran.
And it's on that multi-track level that this entire conference is going to have to address the issue of proliferation for terrorists. Sharon Scorsone directs the Proliferation Prevention Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. David Sanger, it sounds like the inheritance of what Obama confronts is this nuclear terrorism. He's taking the bull by the horns, wouldn't you say, before we go quickly?
He is, but now comes the hard part, because it's easy to agree to lock up loose nuclear material. The hard part is then to go confront those countries that are making more, like Pakistan and India, or those countries that want to go nuclear, like Iran.
David Sanger, New York Times chief Washington correspondent, author of the book The Inheritance.